Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Live from a bunker in the heart of the Ozarks, a podcast that just wants to tell you a joke, it's Sif Pop. Welcome to Sif Pop, available in your podcast feed every Monday, unless, of course, you're a patron.
Because patrons get perks.
Patrons get those perks.
Woo!
I'm your host, Aaron Dicer, and he'd wear his bathrobe to Walmart just to get a pen with ink. It's Andrew Ormsby, ladies and gentlemen.
Ahoy!
And he uses podcasts to balance the fracture within himself. It's John Paula.
Woo! Hello! Nice to be back.
And each week we'll chat about movies, TV, and whatever else from the pop culture universe is on our minds. Hey, guys. Welcome back, Jonathan, for one. How has life in the great Northeast been as we head into the winter?
Oh, it's delightful. We're getting 75-degree days in November. What's not to love? I don't know if my children will be able to enjoy ocean levels where they are in 20, 30 years, but for now, it's very pleasant.
It is kind of the thing with climate change is you just got to, you know, see the silver linings in the storm clouds.
Yeah, we can go bike riding in our shorts like on November 4th. Like, okay, sure.
Why not? I've been itching to start a fire because last winter was the first winter that I decided, hey, let's use our actual fireplace. Let's put logs in there, light them on fire, and warm up the room that way.
Never got cold.
And the thing about that is the room's going to get really hot if it's not cold outside. Because it's not like you want to leave your AC on while you're building a fire. And so I've been itching. So finally, a couple of days ago, it got down in the 40s overnight. And the high the next day was supposed to be 60. And I was like, I think we can do it. I think we can do a fire in the fireplace. And so first thing in the morning, I got up. I put a fire in the fireplace, enjoyed it. It was pleasant as all get out till about noon. And then the house it was like 85 upstairs for the rest of the day. It's like, oh, well, at least I got to build a fire. So I got to satisfy that urge a little bit.
That's like latent lizard brain material for, you know, for men. Like, I need to build fire, warmth. Uh-huh. It's one of those things that, like, same reason why we love throwing big rocks into lakes. It's like, that's just like an instinct. We need to build fire. We need to smash things. Like, I totally relate. It's sort of a... Yeah, a very latent instinct we have. Make fire.
Well, and the other part of it is, like, last year I bought a rick of wood at the end of the winter to just let it sit in my garage and dry out, like, all summer long and everything like that, so that it would be super dry, you know, at the beginning. Because last year some of the wood we got was still a little bit, you know, it hadn't cured enough or whatever they call it with wood. I don't remember if curing is what they call it, but it, you know, there was still a little bit of moisture in it. And so it was a little more difficult, but, I've been super excited to use that wood that's been in my garage for, you know, 6 months now, or whatever. So yeah, I've been loving it. And, part of that has to do with building the upside down fire. Which is one of my favorite things to do is to just light the top and then just it burns for like 3 hours if you've set it up correctly. You don't have to stoke it or put more wood on or
That's awesome.
Anything. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun. Well, there you go. fires on Sif Pop. That's what we're talking about this week. No, that's not what we're talking about today. We are going to talk about Joker Folly Adieu now that it's out on VOD. We missed that one while I was on vacation. So that seems like a touchdown.
A lot of people.
Yeah, apparently
it did
so.
Not too well.
And then also We Live in Time will be the final artifact today, which is Andrew Garfield and Florence Pugh. So we'll get those movies out. We'll do Best Modern Musicals, Best Ever Challenge, Best Modern Musicals.
Excited for this category.
Yeah, yeah. There's been some good ones. There's been a lot of good ones, actually, since the year 2000. But first, we'll kick it off with some buried treasure. What is that one thing in any area of pop culture that you want to make sure people know about? Andrew Ormsey, why don't you kick us off?
I'm going to go with the Drew Goddard directed film. Not Cabin in the Woods. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people were probably thinking that because of the Halloween era, but no. I'm going to go with Bad Times at the El Royale.
Yes.
I absolutely love this movie. I put it on the other day. Don't know why it just popped into my head, and I thought, you know what? That's
you had seen it before, right?
Oh, I'd seen it, yeah. We did a review of it it came out, but I hadn't seen it in years and years. And I was just scrolling through my iTunes list of movies that I own, and I saw it, and I'm like, Oh, I just remember that was such a clever and unique movie. What I love most about it is, besides the amazing performances, is the themes that go on in this movie, the themes of choice and options. The entire movie is based around a hotel where it's right on the state line, so you have the option. Half of the hotel is in Nevada, the other half is in California. And the entire movie is based around important choices in one's life. We see the choices of people in their faith, in their jobs, in their careers, in their choices to make, you know, that impact their entire life. And it's all themed around this crazy, wacky hotel that people find themselves staying in. What I really appreciate, because I went back after I watched the movie, I went back and I listened to our review of the movie. And something Aaron said that really popped out to me. Actually, I went back and I listened to two of our podcasts. I listened to the Joker podcast because I was curious what everybody's thoughts were on the first Joker.
Yeah.
So I went and I re-listened to that. And then I went and I re-listened to our Bad Times at the El Royale. And you said something, Aaron, that I found very interesting whenever we were talking about Bad Times at the El Royale. And that was, whenever we were talking about choices and stuff like that, you brought that up and really unlocked that theme for me. But also, whenever we were talking about, I just lost it. I'm sorry.
That's all right. It's the only time I've ever said something interesting. I was getting excited. I was like, I said something. I said something interesting.
No.
Well, while you ponder on that, Andrew, the one thing that I think is really fun as a reviewer for many years, one of the things I love to do is watch a movie I've mostly forgotten, and then I go to log it on Letterboxd, and I'm like, that's right. I reviewed this when it came out 12 years ago, and then I read over my review. I'm like, this guy was onto something. I agree with everything he wrote.
Yep.
It's like, that was 10 years ago. Of course I agree with my – and it's always really fun revisiting a review or a podcast that you forget doing. Because you're all of your thoughts are like articulated back to yourself.
It's like a little diary. Everybody should have some sort of, you know, film diary. That the Letterboxd is really good for that. So,
I remember now what it was. Yeah, it was about John Hamm and how his performance at the beginning of the movie seemed off to you, Aaron. And you were like, I don't know if I really like this or not. And then the movie has a revelation. And then all of a sudden you're like, I love the John Hamm performance. It's so good.
It's the greatest performance of all time.
No, but it's really interesting how that just shows how smart the movie is with the way that it hides its secrets from the audience and to hide it in a meta way behind a quote unquote bad performance when in all reality it's a good performance. We just don't know it yet.
Mm-hmm.
It just shows how clever Drew Goddard is, not only with his directing, but also with his writing. I think that he's an absolute stunner. I can't wait to see The Matrix 5 that he's directing and writing, I think.
So,
that's a thing? That's the first I'm hearing about that.
A lot of great things. I think this is going to be only his third movie he ever directs is The Matrix, because he's mainly just a writer.
Yep, he is writing and directing the next Matrix movie, and I could not be more excited for that movie. The last Matrix movie, well, this will not be the last time that it's mentioned today, and it will definitely get a mention coming up here later in the show. So,
interesting.
So just a little tease for you there. But yeah, I love Bad Times, and I'm glad you got a chance to check that out. Jonathan, what about you? What's your buried treasure this week?
So I'm coming hot off the heels of Hooptober, which is my annual horror movie viewing challenge in the month of October. And 6 years ago in 2018, I set out to watch 31 movies. And the one I missed was Pedro Almodovar's 2011 psychological thriller, The Skin I Live In, with Antonio Banderas. And I finally sort of made good on that promise from 6 years ago and watched it this year. And of the 31 movies I watched in 2024, this was my favorite one. It is a Spanish language film from, I think, 2011, I said. And it's the kind of thing that has a lot of good twists and turns, and a movie that sort of unravels in unexpected ways. Antonio is so good in this movie. There's a little bit of betrayal. There's a little bit of like violence and like a tinge of like Taken, like Liam Neeson's Taken, a bit of like parental revenge on their kids. And it deals with sexuality and identity and revenge in really fascinating ways. And it was the kind of thing, I went into it mostly cold and I had no idea what was going to happen. And I love when a movie surprises me, and I love even more when it has like deep, meaningful themes and a movie that sticks the landing in a great way. And but not to give any of that third act stuff away, but it was like, oh shoot, this is incredible all of a sudden. I was in it before, but like the last 30 minutes where things kind of lock into place, it's like, oh, this was more than I thought, and it's better than I thought. The Skin I Live In, big recommendation if you haven't ever heard of it or seen it. But it is a more popular horror movie, so you might have heard of it.
It is good. I recommend it as well.
I haven't seen it, and in fact, I need to go on Almodovar. Yeah,
I was guessing.
I need to go on a Pedro run because I've really only seen his movies since I've become a movie critic. Like, I haven't gone back and watched some of the older stuff. I've just seen like Pain and Glory and Parallel Mothers. And then I've even seen the one from this year. Just watched it this week, in fact, The Room Next Door. And not to spoil any possible review of that at any point in time, but with all three of those, I had the same feeling, which is this is a talented director who I just don't connect to. I like those movies, all three of them had great performances. They looked beautiful, and I came away going, eh. So I need to go back and live the Pedro Almodovar experience. And kind of understand how he became who he is. So I'm sure I will go on a Pedro run and see The Skin I Live In as well.
My only experience with him prior was All About My Mother with Penelope Cruz from 1999. And I loved that as well. But I don't usually select out movies just because I liked another movie. I like to pick it on sort of themes and actors and things. And it's like, all right, I do know of this man. I did like his last movie, so this will maybe be a winner. And yeah. Happy to report it once.
And maybe he might be my 2025 director. I've been doing De Palma this year. I've been knocking off all the
you pick one and just try to get all of them.
Yeah, and I've really enjoyed that. And I think Pedro Almodovar, Pedro Almodovar is the one, is a good one possibly for the next year. So we'll see. Right on. I want to talk about a movie called Sing Sing. I think it's been out for a while. I don't know if either of you have seen it. It's available on VOD now, but this is Colman Domingo. It's been out for enough time that technically, according to IMDb, it's a 2023 movie. I think that's because it was at some awards festival in 2023.
This is top 250 on IMDb, on Letterboxd. This is number 180 all time. Yeah.
All time. Okay, cool. It's great. Whoa. And I want to recommend it to you. This is a story of a program in prison, a very specific prison program where the prisoners do performances. They can be Shakespearean, but they're stage performances. And Colman Domingo is one of only two, I think, actors in this that aren't the actual as themselves prisoners or former prisoners. playing in this movie.
Really?
So
that's very, you can't see it on the podcast, but I just raised my eyebrows so high. I could have knocked the hat off. I was like, really? That's very fascinating and kind of a gutsy call to have a bunch of non-actors with that kind of background.
Yeah.
But if they're playing like versions of themselves, it makes sense. That's actually really cool.
Yes. I really, really liked it. I'm a sucker for a story about the power of art and the power of involving yourself in art and the power 100%. Of creativity. There's a lot of those this year, by the way. I am deep into like watching, 12 movies a day mode right now.
Are you really? I'm jealous.
that's a bit of an exaggeration. Well, let's see how much of an exaggeration that is. Let's look
I've
at my
never watched 12 a day in my life, so that would be
Johnson. No, while he's looking that up, if you want a recommendation for another movie or a series where it's half actors, half the real people that actually lived it, on a HBO, look up Generation Kill. It's about the Marine recon unit that was one of the first units that deployed into Iraq.
There's and a little bit of that in United 93 as well. There's some some play themselves stuff. I've watched about 12 movies over the last 3 days, so it's about 4 movies a day that I'm trying to rock it through. And a lot of that. By the way, if you follow me on Letterboxd, you can check out my awards list. I do this every year, where I average out the awards predictions from the three major awards publications, and then just put that list of the possible Best Picture winners on Letterboxd. This year's list had 96 films on it. I'm about halfway through those 96.
Oh my gosh. So. Only 5 out of 96. Oh, wait. To be fair, I have not logged in a couple months. I have a bad backlog I need to import. But still, I have my work cut out for me if I've only seen 5 of these.
Well, there will usually be 3 to 5 of them that don't actually come out. That's just the nature of the award season. Like for instance, some of them that I've seen for this year actually were on last year's list. That's just kind of the way it works. But yeah, you can check that out in my Letterbox, kind of what I'm going through. But back to Sing Sing. Check it out. It's on VOD, and it made me cry a couple times. I think it's really, really beautiful. So
I'm assuming it takes place in Sing Sing prison.
I don't think it does. I think that is a play on Sing Sing prison, but the idea is like, performance,
singing and singing.
Yeah. Kind of thing. So
Is this list of yours sorted by any criteria?
Yes. Yes. So basically the I use Awards Watch, Variety, and Gold Derby. And they all do a pretty detailed ranking, and then I just do a straight point ranking. So, like, one.
So the movies at the top are the most likely to win.
Correct. Correct.
Gotcha. Okay.
And cool. last year, I mean, you can check the last few years. I think it's the fourth year I've done it. Everything Everywhere All at Once, I think, was number 4 when I did it and ended up winning. Again, I do this in the middle of October, so there's still obviously a long way to go in the race, but I think last year's winner,
pole position, once.
Yep. So there you go. Anyways, Sing Sing is great. You should check it out. So that is Sing Sing, available on VOD. Bad Times at the El Royale, I think, available on VOD as well. And The Skin I Live In is on Max, if you want to check that out. All right, well, let's get into the first review. Let's do the big dig. Let's talk about Joker, Folie à Deux.
2 years ago, the name Arthur Fleck hit Gotham like a hurricane.
The trial of the century.
They believe Arthur Fleck to be some kind of martyr. Well, he's not. He's a monster.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling.
When I first saw Joker, when I saw you,
the whole world smiled.
For once in my life, I didn't feel so alone anymore.
While struggling with his dual identity, Arthur Fleck not only stumbles upon true love, but also finds the music that's always been inside him. This is Joaquin Phoenix coming back to do a role that won him an Oscar. How many years ago? That couldn't have been too long ago.
5 years ago. 2019, I think.
Yeah, 5 years ago, won him an Oscar. Todd Phillips coming back to direct a follow-up to a movie that made almost $1 billion worldwide.
Over a billion dollars
worldwide. And we are far enough into this movie's release to say this will not make that much worldwide. It's been a flop.
It's not even going to make... I don't even think it broke $60 million domestic. Like, it just cratered. Nobody wanted to see this. I haven't seen a movie this large. Like, it was a $200 million budget, one of the biggest IPs on the planet, DC Comics, and it went nowhere. Like, nobody saw it opening weekend, and it dropped like 84% weekend to one of the all time worst second weekend drops. I waited until it was out at home. I'm like, I'm not going to waste a night and drive all the way down to the theater for this. Like, this is. it was a rough go.
One of the reasons I wanted to get to this, Andrew, is this famously is one we've disagreed on since it came out. That's what I mean. Like, this franchise, the first movie, was, I think, your best of that year, if I remember correctly, or at least one of the best of that year for you in 2019.
2019, give me 2 seconds. I can tell you where
it is. And I really didn't like it. So I think it's important kind of to follow up, especially with a movie like this, to continue to follow up that discussion. Because honestly, Andrew, as many conversations as we have, I think the majority of them, we kind of have similar, you know, opinions on movies. And so it's always interesting when we have such disparate.
It's Avatar. That's where we're fighting. That's where
we start. Most famously, Last Jedi is probably the big one. That's the whole good dinosaur,
Last Jedi.
Well, Good Dinosaur. I don't know. We actually disagree on that movie over all that
the
much.
The theme of it is what we disagree.
Just we got in a big tussle over the themes in that movie. I do want to start with you, Andrew, since you loved the first one so much. Did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay?
Real quick, just back in 2019, this was my number 3 movie of the year, right behind 1917 and Parasite.
Mm-hmm.
Good film.
Makes sense.
Absolutely loved the first Joker movie. This one, I really did not like.
Okay. Strong didn't like. Jonathan, what about you? Like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or was just okay?
And as a refresher, I thought the original was pretty good. I would say high side, I liked it. Right between you guys, I think. This one, the follow-up, I would say low side of all right. I didn't hate it. I didn't dislike it. It was fine.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Nice.
I hated this movie. So, Jonathan, you liked it the most.
Number one movie of the year, ladies and gentlemen.
So you get to tell us why this movie. You get to tell us why this movie is so amazing. No, just give us your general thoughts. What are some of your thoughts on Joker Folie à Deux?
I was going to say, like, gun to my head, you want me to defend this movie? I don't think I can for longer than a couple points. I think right off, Todd Phillips has a really good cinematic eye.
Yes.
It's hard. It's easy to forget that this guy started with the Hangover movies. But then you watch this, and there's a really great one take in the middle of the film at the courthouse, and it goes outside. It goes through a tunnel. He gets into a car. And it's this long, like, 5-minute shot. And I was kind of like, wow, this is actually – cinematically and technically, like, really impressive. I'm immersed. I'm in this moment with these characters. But, like, outside of that and some of the musical moments where the tap dancing and the vibe of, like, the big band, old-style Hollywood numbers, I don't want to say they swept me off my feet because they never approached anything approaching, like, classical musicals. But there were a few moments where I was like, oh, yeah, no, this kind of has a beat to it. This is all right. I'm enjoying it. Those moments are few and far between, and a majority of the picture I thought was just too slow, too uninteresting. And it all happens mostly in the prison or in the courtroom or in his mind. And it's like this – I desperately wanted it to, like, break out to something bigger, but it was just like a really insular story that didn't really take our characters anywhere different than where we left them in the last one. And I think that for me was maybe the worst part about it is there's no – I don't know, point. It feels so reductive to be derivative in that way and to reduce it to, like, what was the point? But, like, I don't know what – maybe you guys can help me figure it out. I just watched it earlier today, so it's fresh in my mind. And I don't know that I've really sat with it long enough to know.
Well, we're not going to spoil it now. However, I will say this. When we review a movie that's been out for a little bit, I'm a little more willing to have the spoiler conversation within the podcast proper. So we may talk for a little bit and then – talk a few spoilers as long as we warn people. But we're not talking those yet. Andrew, why don't you go next? What are some of your general thoughts on JFAD?
To echo what John said, the cinematography is very impressive in this movie. I think that some of the shots are just right out of a picture. You have Todd Phillips, like you said, the guy who did Hangover is the guy who's making these very beautiful cinematic shots. But it's like putting makeup on a pig because the story is so lacking. It lacks entertainment value. It lacks any sensical structure. It lacks any narrative understanding. There's just so many.
I mean, it's almost 2.5 hours long, and I felt like the actual narrative had enough meat to support like a 30-minute short. Like, there's not enough happens. There's not enough beats in this story, and yet somehow it's 2.5 hours. Like,
there's only one beats in this story. Zazzy.
Yes. Yes, I will give shout outs to performances though, because I do think that there are some really good acting performances in this movie. Joaquin Phoenix, I don't think he's as good as he was in the first movie, but he's still doing good. Somebody I really want to give a shout out to is Lee Gill, who plays Gary Puddles, who I thought his scene was probably, if I'm going to hang my hat on a scene in a movie, in this movie where I'm like, you know what? I was emotionally invested.
Yes.
I cared about what was happening here. This movie hooked me for a moment. It was probably the Gary Puddles scene. Yeah. But that's not for like an hour, 45 minutes into the movie.
Well, I'll shift into some of my thoughts bouncing off of that, which is to say, I wanted to see the actual movie that Gary Puddles scene was meant to be in, because that is the only moment in the movie for me that seemed to actually have something interesting to say. It was the one scene in the movie where I felt, oh, is that what this movie is trying to go for? Is that what it's trying to say? But it never says it again, and it never said it before then. And so I shall say I didn't see it before then. I didn't see it after then. But I do think he was really great, and that scene was good. Here are my general thoughts. Joker Folie à Deux is the wonderful, perfect thing to go see when you want to see four terrible movies in one. If you want to see a terrible courtroom drama, I've got the movie for you.
I thought it was going to really kick up when it got to court, and it didn't.
If you want to see a terrible musical, have I got the movie for you? If you want to see a terrible mystery thriller, boy, have I got the movie for you.
I was about to ask, what is the next theme? Because mystery thriller, I wasn't even on my radar as one of the possible genres that made up this. Whatever. Fourth is what? Romance?
No, comic book movie. If you want to see a terrible comic book movie, have I got the movie for you? Sure, you can throw rom-com in there as well. Although I don't. The thing about the other four is they are all very much intended. This is intended to be a courtroom drama. This is intended to be a musical. This is intended to be a mystery theater thriller. And don't tell me it's not when you see where it ends up. Like, this is supposed to be all four of those things. And it's just terrible at all four of them. And I don't necessarily need to go one by one, but I will. And we'll start with the musical.
Yes.
Was there an original song in this?
What do you mean?
I thought the mountain one, Mountaintop, we're going to build a mountain. I thought that was original, but I didn't look it up.
I think there may have been one, but otherwise it was just standards and classic stuff. And
really, I didn't know that.
And what was?
I wouldn't even call it a jukebox musical because they weren't like pop hits. They're like old. That's entertainment. That's from a Fred Astaire movie from 1955. Like, what are we doing?
That's what I'm saying. And it wasn't that thing too, where it just, you lock into the lyrics of a song and recontextualize it in a new way or whatever.
Right.
And I think they were thinking that's what it was, but it never worked that way for me. You have Lady Gaga, and this is what you give her to do. You don't even let her really like belt or sing, or it's so bad. The choreography, and by the way, I'm going to get to a point where I admit that I think a lot of this is intentional, but we will get there. You know, the choreography is terrible. It's not a great musical. The courtroom drama stuff not only is just not great courtroom tension. Like, you're never, thinking, like, how is he going to, be exonerated? Yeah. How is he going to be guilty? What is the qualifying testimony? Like, oh, no, surprise witness. What is this? None of that stuff is there. The movie doesn't even care about that, because there is no resolution to the courtroom drama. There is nothing that the movie even hints at about guilt or innocence.
It's not interested in it. It doesn't seem interested in developing that in a way that is satisfying. It's just a background for another set piece.
Well,
I was going to say, Aaron, you and I are huge fans of like classic movie musicals and Singing in the Rain and American in Paris. And I was hoping we'd get some of those like really cool lucid dream sequences where like the walls fall down and the lights come up and he's tap dancing on the judge's desk and like all big brass numbers and confetti, like a whole thing. I wanted a big musical moment that had like a great toe tapping song. And it was just like, oh, you rented one spotlight and had Joaquin put on tap shoes and it's only 38 seconds long. Like, what are we doing? This isn't good music. It's not a good dance. It's not a good musical. It's just all the ingredients of a good musical were absent. And I thought we would get it. Well, the comic book stuff, whatever. The mystery thriller, fine. The romance, we're not. Like, at least give me one of those things correctly. Oh, so frustrating. I'm talking myself into a lower rating.
the comic book stuff is much less present even in this one than the first one. And that's an interesting thing where I think I even argued in the first one, and you've heard our review more recently than I have, Andrew, as you just listened to it recently. But my memory is that I felt like they should have left the comic book stuff completely out of the first one, that there's some kind of movie that could have been made, possibly call it like Taxi Driver or King of Comedy. Name it something like that that hasn't been done before, but that there's a movie there where it's not tied into the DC universe in any way, and it might become a better movie. And this movie took that advice and went, well, it's still, we're going to call it Joker, but we're going to try that even though we're calling it Joker, and not really tie anything in except maybe the end. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. The end's interesting, right? That could be saying something about the DC universe. No, it's really not. And it's not interesting. And again, that's the part of the reason the mystery thriller part doesn't work, because the movie doesn't even care about its main character enough for us to feel any tension about that character or what the truth is or what's going on with them. So, yeah, there you go.
And they didn't even have the guts to have Lady Gaga's character be called Harley Quinn. They had to like pull back and cowardly be like, well, we'll just call her Lee. Like, guys, are you going to do it or not? Like, this half-assed mentality where we want to like dabble in the IP and leverage it for the audience, but not actually commit to having anything resembling these characters is such a cowardly, it's opportunistic. It's like, we want to use Harley Quinn because everyone likes her, but we're not going to have her resemble that character in any meaningful way. And we don't even call her that. I think they use the name, Harley Quinzel once, but otherwise she's always just referred to as Lee. And I'm like, it's a blink if you miss it. If you didn't already know these characters, you wouldn't recognize them here.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating as a comic book fan as well.
So, I think it's a failure.
Definitely a failure. I think this movie's trying to say something about cult mentality as well, but it's so on the surface that I feel like it's not hitting the mark on where it needs to. You know what? I'll just say this. I think that they realized, oh, we made a $1 billion movie last time. We have to make a sequel. Yes. And how do we make a sequel to a movie that, by all accounts, shouldn't have been given one? And when I say that, I don't mean because it didn't deserve it. I mean because the story was finished. I think that the story of Joker and Arthur Fleck had come to fruition, and that this doesn't add anything new to the story. It doesn't expand on why he becomes Joker. It doesn't expand on Gotham. It doesn't expand on anything.
I think it wink-winks at the end, and we can talk about that when I open up spoilers here in a little bit.
Yeah, because I definitely have something to say in spoilers.
Yeah. This is, you mentioned the mentality, cult mentality themes that might be playing around here. And I think that leads me to the second part of my thoughts on this movie, which I mentioned, we'll be talking about the intentionality. I think this is intentionally, maybe not bad, but intentionally made in a way to upset the fans of the first movie that Todd Phillips didn't identify with. I think this is reactionary filmmaking from Todd Phillips. I think they felt like they had to do another one because it made almost $1 billion.
Yeah.
And Todd was like, okay, but there's no way anybody's going to come out of this one thinking that the Joker is a clarion call for, some certain kind of, human being. And at every turn, he is saying the Joker is weak, the Joker is wrong, the Joker is, whatever it may be, the Joker is abandoned, all of these things. And I think that's very much intentional. I mentioned earlier that the most recent Matrix movie would be coming up because I think there's a familiar thing going on here, it feels like to me, where a filmmaker has said, you got to make another one of these. And they're like, okay, what about this then? And just completely put two middle fingers up, to the audience. With a lot of their choices. And I think there's a little bit of that going on here.
Do you think it's intentional?
I think a lot of it might be intentional and honestly kind of makes me like the movie a little bit better. I would put that in the pro column. There's something about
making an intentionally bad movie.
Well, not again, let me clarify. I said intentionally upsetting to those who took a certain message from the first movie. So I think that results in a bad movie for many reasons. And I think other ways this movie is a bad movie have nothing to do with that. But I do think there is a portion of what's going on here in the lack of seeming care for the Joker character that has to do with Todd Phillips going, there's a good portion of you that took the wrong things, from this movie. So that feels right to me. And that's not an original thought on my part. I've actually heard others talk about this. So I want to be clear on that as well, but I did vibe with me that could be the case.
I would agree that there was maybe some intentionality to being subversive and not giving the audience what they wanted, but what Todd Phillips wanted them to see.
Yes.
And I kind of appreciate that. I like when directors take swings and don't just listen to and deliver fan service. Like, I want you to give me your singular vision, not deliver me what I think I want. The problem is I don't know that Todd wanted it either. I think the studio probably mandated it. And the fact that they spent $200 million on this would signal to me that they didn't make it bad intentionally. Cause like it's like the Dark Knight. You have a pile of money. You're just setting it on fire. Like, hey guys, look, wouldn't it be cool if we made a movie that cost $250 million and nobody liked it? Like that's stupid.
So, but like what I'm saying is, so intentionality as it relates to like the musical aspect of this, they didn't want Lady Gaga to be an amazing singer. They didn't want the musical scenes to feel polished and great, and because they wanted it to feel like the Joker is a loser and the Joker is terrible at everything he does, and even in his imagination, and that's another part of the movie we could talk. Listen, there's so many parts of this movie I could talk about that are annoying to me, but the what's real and what's not in this movie is even more annoying than it was in the first one. Because in the first one, I think in the first one, you have a pretty clear understanding at least of what was mostly real and what wasn't. In this one, I still don't know if they actually had sex. I still don't know if she's actually pregnant. I still don't know. Like, there's so many things like, that you like, did the judge actually let him wear that costume and makeup in the courtroom? Like, you know, that you just go, that doesn't ring true. Like, no judge is just going to be like, hey, I'll let you represent yourself and go ahead and wear the murderer costume that, you know, you're known for while we're doing the proceeding. Just make a complete mockery out of my courtroom, please.
And he was broadcast it live. Like, none of that seemed like a good idea.
Right.
Like, no judge in the country would let you just with that. I'm going to allow it. Like, come on. Let's be.
So, yeah. So the movie, it doesn't have a way for me to grasp on and go, okay, here's even the facts on the ground. Like, I don't even understand necessarily sometimes. So, so that was another annoying part of watching this movie.
Are we to where I can talk spoilers now?
You know what? Let's do it. Let's talk about the end of the movie. Let's talk about, a few things you might want to talk about. I will say, if you're listening to this, I will just make sure and really say it. We are actually going to spoil the end of the movie during the episode. So if you don't want to hear it, just jump ahead to the next timestamp.
I think Todd Phillips, and this is going to be a very unpopular opinion, I think Todd Phillips chickened out. I think that he chickened out at the end of this movie when he made Arthur Fleck mournful for what he did. I think that if they had made it to where Arthur Fleck just committed to being Joker, and not only that, he doubled down on being Joker, and he became who we expected to see in the comics. He becomes the most vile, evil villain ever because...
Yeah, becomes a supervillain, right.
He becomes a supervillain. If you look at... I know I just talked about this show last week, but if you look at The Penguin on HBO Max right now, there are no good guys. Every decision in that show is a decision made by a supervillain, where there's no redeeming characters. There's no... you root for characters, but you're rooting for, like... Something that the show talks about and something that this movie could have taken a note from is things aren't always in black and white. There are areas of gray. There are areas of gray in people's morality. There are areas of gray in people's decisions and who and what makes them who they are. So we could have seen positive aspects of Arthur Fleck like they did in this movie or like they could have done in this movie, but they didn't. They just made him a nothing character. And I think that if they would have committed to making him the supervillain that he actually was, it would have been a more controversial movie because you're looking at a movie where nobody is good. And it could have possibly led to more conversations about mental health, which is, I think, the big thing that a lot of people had issues with in the first movie. And Aaron,
yeah, it kind of glorified some of that stuff.
Glorified mental health. Didn't glorify mental illness. It made it to where it compared mentally ill people to criminals, and I think that was the issue.
And it celebrated
that,
though, and it celebrated those like violent acts. And it's like, well, that's the wrong message. And I agree, though. I don't think that is a particularly controversial opinion to say that Phillips chickened out, because I'm inclined to say that I wanted to see him kind of lean into that character and make him truly unhinged. And like, I expected that they were going to, the naivety on my part here, I expected them to lean in more to the Batman verse. And at the end of the movie, he would become the Joker. We would finally see like the full rise of this character and how he inspired all these people. And instead, he just kind of wimps out and is like, nah, I don't want to do that. And like, I actually want, and yeah, it's frustrating for sure.
Okay, so this plays into a lot of what I've been talking about, and maybe I can clarify it as we circle around the ending here. The mental illness aspect of the first movie is the part I think Todd Phillips connected the most to. And I think he wanted empathy for a human being that was experiencing mental illness. The fact, and I think I talked about this in our first review, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Andrew, the fact that that had to be a supervillain in the Batman universe complicates that goal. It makes that goal very difficult to achieve because you're dealing with somebody who has to end up as a supervillain, who has to end up without our empathy, you know, has to end up going, making the wrong choice, being the terrible person. And I think Todd Phillips wanted to have conversations about how mental illness can impact people and leave them alone and leave them unprotected and those kind of things. And so Todd Phillips comes back to this movie and goes, you guys took the villain part wasn't the part I wanted to focus on. I wanted to focus on the mental illness part, and doubles down on Arthur Fleck, you know, being abandoned, being mentally ill, and strips away from him the supervillain part. And I think that's because of both what you're talking about with the mental illness and also, you know, what I mentioned before about the admiration that many have for the Joker character that he didn't want to, you know, play into or whatever. At the end of this movie, we see, in my opinion, what's going on here, and maybe you guys completely disagree. We see the birth of the Joker. It's just not Arthur Fleck. I think this movie is saying that Arthur Fleck was the inspiration for the eventual actual Joker, and that the end story here is that a mentally unwell human being was abandoned by everybody around him and died a lonely death, and his, you know, only echo in this world is that then somebody took what he did not intend and turned it into, you know, this supervillain kind of thing. Because don't we see that guy at the end cut his a smile into his face with the knife?
That's right.
Like I think in the that's
background, the it's not focus, but it's there.
Yeah, I think the idea is that's the Joker, or you know, the idea is that Arthur Fleck was, you know, the eventual inspiration for
that. May have been an interesting. That may have been an interesting theory or plot thread had they developed it. Like that right. character came out. Like, was that character in the movie earlier, and I just don't remember him
because.
Yeah,
he didn't speak at all, but the camera kept cutting to him.
Yeah.
Right. I don't remember. Did he have like maybe one line of dialogue early in the movie when they're watching the TV in the prison? I think
something like that.
I think he was making fun of Arthur Fleck at one point, but like we didn't know a lot about his backstory. We didn't know anything about how he came to that prison. And it's frustrating because it's like, oh, all right. So you're going to dangle like one more little carrot. Maybe this is where it's going to go, which I think makes sense with the timeline that they established, because in this universe, Joker's 50 years old and Batman's 10. Mm-hmm. So, all right, yeah. It makes sense that he's not the villain. He's maybe the inspiration for the villain. And that is a potentially interesting idea that they don't explore at all.
I thought it was going to be Harley's kid. She's going to raise the kid to be Joker.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a movie. Why didn't we get that?
Yeah.
That's another.
Because we don't even know if she's actually pregnant, Jonathan. That's why we didn't get that. So anyhow, I think that the ending of the movie is just another example of Todd Phillips going, you had it wrong. It wasn't about this. It was, you know, I genuinely wanted you to feel bad for this human being. And you know, that's why at the end they recant, everything. And they just wanted to be loved.
Let me ask you both this, and it may be a blatant no. Do you have, after the first movie and this movie, do you have any empathy at all for Arthur Fleck?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Not like a lot, but yeah, I empathize with him on a human level, and he's clearly going through some things. And what I loved about the original movie is that when he murders those guys on the subway, I was like, yes, they were jerks. It was a little of an overreaction, but like I empathize with like, you're being picked on. You're the smaller person. And you finally have a means and a mechanism to fight back. And I can kind of relate to that. Again, not condoning murder, but like I appreciated that underdog kind of element. This movie didn't have that, which is – actually, it did. The one scene was with Gary Puddles where I kind of felt like, oh, I understand this man's plight and this man's anger and his fear in a way that was more interesting than everything else on either side of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what they could have done with that scene – and I know we're trying to move on. Sorry.
No, you're good.
What they could have done with that Gary Puddles scene – throughout the entire movie is show like, Arthur, you complained in the first movie that you were abandoned, that you were traumatized, that you were hurt by other individuals. Here are the ramifications for your actions. You have hurt, you have abandoned, you have traumatized individuals with your actions. So it could have been a collateral damage, you know, scenario that they could have shown, but it's so fleeting that I don't think that message hits home.
It's every time you've opened your mouth, Andrew, you've provided another more interesting story than the one we got. I'm like, yeah. I'm sitting nodding my head, like listening, like, yes, that actually sounds like a really compelling kind of role reversal on the psychology of the thesis. Why didn't we get that? Instead we got this sort of weird pastiche of musical dream sequences that like it doesn't amount to anything. The actual narrative doesn't move, it's sort of stuck in place. The characters don't go on any journey of any kind. This movie, I think in a word for me, was frustrating.
Yeah.
Because I wanted it to do something.
I didn't even know until Aaron mentioned it that none of these songs were original songs besides maybe one or two. That
I actually looked it up. Gonna Build a Mountain is also an old song from the 1961 musical The Roar of the Grease Paint, The Smell of the Crowd.
There you go.
I like the movie even less now. That it couldn't even be that original. I'm glad to have
dragged
there.
You both down to my level.
Right, John, are you still in the meh category?
I would ranking this movie. I would maybe give this, like a 3 or 4 out of 10. So this was probably in the didn't like it. Mm. Again, I didn't hate it, but it's just so very blah.
Out of 5, I'd give it a 2.
Yeah. I think I gave it a 1 out of 5. All right, there it is. That's Joker Folia Deux. That is Joker Folia Not Even Worth Deux Stars.
It really is.
Yes.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right, let's move on to the best ever challenge. Modern musicals. These are musicals that have been released. I should say movie musicals, modern movie musicals. Feel free to stretch the category however you want. I will tell you, I left out stage to screen direct transfers. So like Hamilton, I left out those kind of things where it's just like filming the musical. Waitress the Musical is another one recently that was like that. I left those out of mine.
But I also left out Hamilton. It probably would have topped my list if not.
Yeah. And I also kind of favored non-diegetic musicals. I think I have that phrase right. Over ones where the music is just a part of, you know, so like biopics that are about musicians. I kind of left those like Rocket Man, those kind of things. I kind of left those out too. And went with more like songs that were written for story purposes.
That break reality for a minute. To me, that's a real musical. When you break reality to sing and dance, it doesn't quite hit the same when the music is part of the universe.
Yes. So with one possible exception that I might nominate. We'll see. Let's go through it. Oh, really?
Maybe we'll see.
Okay, yeah. Hold on to that to the end. Let's each do 4 nominations. Okay. Since there's 3 of us, and that'll get us 12. So we'll start with Andrew. What's your first nomination? Best modern musical.
I'm gonna go with what I consider my favorite musical ever, and you tell me if it's not modern enough. I'm gonna go with the Moulin Rouge.
No, that's after 2000. That was 2001, I think.
Sure was.
Yeah.
So, interesting thing about Moulin Rouge. What's that?
I said great flick. Love that movie.
Yes, it was on my list of possible nominations as well. This is a great example of how to do already existing songs in a fresh new way for a musical.
This is a jukebox musical and a great one because they're taking songs like Roxanne, which had been around for 30 years at this point, and they're recontextualizing it, and they're having the characters do a new arrangement of it, and they're having the characters sing it in a duet, and it's definitely not a duet originally. And like, wow, that's actually – I've never heard Sting's music performed and sung in that way. That's the reason why, you know, that movie is good.
Yep. That version – that was what going to be my next thing I brought up. That version of Roxanne is my favorite musical number in any movie.
Oh, it's so good.
Just because it's so fresh and unique. And it's a play on an original, so you know the words, but it's something made new. And yeah, the movie, and
it's so the movie's like breathy and intense. And it's so, and Baz Luhrmann is just out there painting with every color in his Crayola box. Like, it's just like a feast of sensory overload. And I remember when I first saw this right out in theaters, but not when it came out, and I was just like, this, I almost need to like rub my eyes every other minute, because I was like overwhelmed with how bright and flashy and fast everything comes at you. I appreciate movies like that.
You're saying he was painting with all the colors of the windmill?
Hey.
Master, all right. Thank you guys. We're ending the podcast there. Everybody have a good night. Appreciate you tuning in. All right. Jonathan, what's your first nomination?
I'll follow Andrew's lead and pick my favorite, which is The Greatest Showman. I think I've talked about it on the show before. This one has a close personal connection to me, because it's one of the first movies my daughter and I connected with. It's also the movie I saw right before she was born. So my wife is – picture this. We're in the theater. It's December of 2017. She's like 9 months pregnant, right? Emery was born like 3 weeks later. And they get to that a million dreams. It's all it's going to take. We're going to build a house, fill it with things from far away. And I'm starting to cry remembering that moment. And it's the kind of thing where I was not in a great place where, like, I don't know how we're going to handle this. We're new parents. We don't have enough money. Like, what are we going to do? Like, are we ready for this? We have a kid like 3 weeks away. And that movie hit me like in all the right moments and all the right feels. And I'm like, no, if P.T. Barnum can do it, gosh darn it, I can do it too. And it filled me with so much hope and optimism. And more than that, it's just every single song is a banger. And I know every word. And then when Emery was old enough, I watched it with her. And watching her like bounce around the couch and sing the songs, and she doesn't really know the words. She's like, "The Greatest Show." She just kind of like mumbles through all the verses and just knows the chorus. And it warms my heart every time we sit down and watch it. And it's just it is definitely a bastardization of a true figure who was a bad person, and they make him out to be a glorified hero. But if you can sort of ignore the whitewashing of P.T. Barnum, the person, just appreciate it as a fictional character. It's three great movies all in one, and I love everything that comes together at the end.
I think it's one of the most amazing movie musical soundtracks ever written.
Every single song is phenomenal. I love that
good
soundtrack.
Every song is
There's
so
also,
good in that
they
movie.
They even released a soundtrack. If I had to pick a favorite, it would probably be From Now On or The Other Side. Those are the two I find myself going back to the most. But what I was going to say is they actually released an album of covers by popular artists. So Zac Brown Band does one of the songs. I think it's From Now On. And they have a bunch of people redo the entire soundtrack, track at a time, but by contemporary people. And that's also a really good album. If you don't want to watch the movie, you just want to hear like country pop music versions of it. Also great. So.
Yeah, if I could just get past that part of taking the thing that made somebody a horrible person and turning it into the thing that made them a great person, I'd love that movie too.
If they would have named it T.P. Barnum, Aaron would have thought it was the greatest musical
good
ever.
Oh yeah, good old toilet paper Barnum. I like that guy. It was great. All right, my first nomination, I'll go ahead and do my favorite as well, which is no surprise, La La Land will be my first nomination. Yeah, talk about great songs. And I think that's kind of a key. I was thinking about this too, is like the sign of a great musical to me is first that you just want to re-listen to the music, and then that it just gets inside you. Like, it just gets inside your soul. Greatest Showman is like that. La La Land is like that. Moulin Rouge is like that. And I think most of our picks will probably be like that. So so yeah, La La Land is my first nomination.
Yes. City of Stars is a track I come back to a lot.
It's
really,
so good.
Really good stuff. Especially if you like modern jazz, I think that movie hits even harder. I'm not the biggest fan of that genre, but La La Land's on my top five of the whatever decade of musicals for sure.
Yeah. Andrew, what's your next nomination?
A movie that came out in 2016 that was criminally underrated, did not get nominated for a single Oscar. I'm going to go with Sing Street.
Yeah, you are. Yes, I knew that was coming.
My favorite movie of the year. It's so good.
It was in my top five movies of 2016. One of my favorite musicals. The music is absolutely brilliant. Drive It Like You Stole It is one of my favorite songs ever. And the movie itself, like the actual story of a young man trying to find out who he is, and he's trying on all these different outfits, literally to try and find out who he wants to be as an as a grown man. And, you know, him falling in love, it's and him trying to he sees himself as a big fish in a little pond, you know, and it's just all these things that the music, while it is so good, isn't really even the thing I think about whenever I think about this movie. I think about the story. I think about the acting. It's just so beautiful.
It really is. I recently rewatched it and was struck by how solid and consistent the brotherhood theme is in this movie as well. Yes. The idea of
Jack Rayner's so good.
He really is. And that stuff in this movie is really good too. This is one of those where I guess technically the music is diegetic.
Is this what you were referring to earlier?
No, because it's interesting. I didn't even think of this one that way because the music feels so written for the story. It feels so original.
Example, in the Drive It Like You Stole It number, it starts as diegetic. They're performing like a school play or a school audition, whatever you want to call it, a talent show. But then it sort of becomes a musical when suddenly the auditorium becomes like a movie set auditorium.
Yeah, right.
Like there's dramatic lighting and there's a huge crowd and like it's their band transforms into like a little three-piece couple of teenagers into like, oh, now suddenly they have, you know, it becomes bigger than it was in their imagination. So it's sort of half diegetic, half musical. And the other thing I wanted to mention about Sing Street is it's low-key, an excellent period film. Like this takes place in, is it Ireland in the 1960s?
Yeah, Ireland, 60s. 80s?
Or in 70s. The 80s. Yeah. And it's one of those things where it's not really like material to the plot other than just they wanted to have late 70s, early 80s style music. So they set it in that time period. But I love that it takes place 40 years ago and it kind of rules because we don't get a lot of movie set in like 80s Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Early 1980s Dublin is what it says. So yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Awesome, hey, I was just awesome there. All right. Jonathan, what's your next nomination?
I'm going to go with a remake of one of the best musicals ever made. That would be Steven Spielberg's West Side Story from 2021. Every single part of this movie I felt was as good, if not better, than the original. And as the original is one of my favorites and one of the best of all time, I was left with only one conclusion that Steven Spielberg's remake is one of the best musicals of the 21st century. I was blown away by how well he adapted it. It doesn't get credit for a lot of it because all of it was already done by Robert Wise and the great was it Sondheimer did the music for this one?
Sondheim.
But it's the kind of thing like and so like Spielberg doesn't get the credit for, you know, a lot of this stuff, but taking such a well-known and iconic film with, you know, total earworms and updating it in a way that felt fresh and exciting, and he rearranged some of the musical numbers that I thought better serviced the story. It's what a remake is supposed to be, and it's one of my favorite Spielberg films after kind of a pretty good lull for him where I was not really liking much of what he did for a couple decades. And then he came roaring back with that in The Fabelmans. So that makes my list. I love it.
It's very, very good. It was on my list as well of possible nominees. Speaking of Sondheim, Sondheim plays into my next nominee. Which is Tick, Tick, Boom.
Dang it, I got to find something else. Give me a second.
good pick. That's another great one.
This is actually one I didn't know if would count because it's technically a biopic, too.
It is. For me, though, it is different in that what we're seeing from the movie is, like, for instance, the this is the life, like that stuff is happening in the scene, but then becomes, you know, more later. There are, you know, like you mentioned with Sing Street, how it transitions into production or fantasy or those kind of things. We definitely get that here. It uses the songs in very story based ways. I don't know. It squeaked over that line for me to be in a. This feels like a musical to me, not just a biopic. So
okay. Yeah, no, I like that one a lot.
It's so good. Like I said, if you wouldn't have picked it, I would have. So
nice.
And it's also another one of those films that I think a lot of people slept on. I don't think that I know he was nominated for it, but I don't think Tick, Tick, Boom was, you know, widely seen by people outside of like film circles. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
Yeah, it should have been. So good.
Should have been.
Andrew, what's your next nominee?
I'm going to go with 2004's The Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, okay.
I've actually not seen this adaptation yet.
I think Gerard Butler is a surprisingly good singer. I did not expect to hear his voice be as good as it is. This is a movie that actually surprised me because, as you guys know, I'm not a big music guy. I like some every now and then, but especially movies like this, which is a straight musical through from beginning to end, nonstop music, you know, that is definitely not my cup of tea. But for some reason, I thought that the acting was great. I think that the music, obviously, is astounding. Past the Point of No Return is such a great song. I just think that it did everything right. That it did everything it was supposed to do for a musical.
Nice.
Yeah.
I've seen the original from whatever one Lon Chaney's in from 25 or 26, and even without music, as it's a silent film, it's such a riveting story, and obviously has been remade over the years. So thank you for the reminder to check it out.
Yeah. Jonathan, what's your next nominee?
Let's see. One we haven't mentioned yet. I'm going to go out on a limb. I don't know that many people like this as much as me. And another remake here, but the 2017 Beauty and the Beast. And I think for a lot of the same reasons, all of Alan Menken's and Howard Shore's music from the animated version still slap. They are incredible ballads. And when you update it with all of the pomp and circumstance of a big budget live action adventure and throw in a couple new numbers, which I think are also excellent. There's one that Dan Stevens sings called Evermore. And I think another one of those movies that I've fallen in love with because of my young girls. We've watched both versions a bunch, and it's a great story. I think it also, this remake fixed a lot of the issues I had with the animated version, where there's like little plot holes and little things that don't make sense. And this movie's like, well, what if we made it a half hour longer and actually kind of clued in and glued together parts of this that maybe didn't make sense. And I think it's a stronger film because of it. All of Emma Watson's auto-tuned criticisms. No.
I'm a Beauty and the Beast live action apologist. I enjoyed that movie. I think it's
the best live action remake they've done. I'll put it that way.
Mm, I think Cinderella might be, but I'd actually have to give it a little more thought. I liked Aladdin too, though. Well, I guess for my nomination then, since we're kind of flirting with it already, I'll do the first animated musical. And I'll go with, I have to go with Frozen, I think, as the first. Anderson and Lopez are incredible songwriters. I think all the music in Frozen, there's a reason that movie blew up the way it did. It is like La La Land, Greatest Showman to me, where like you're just singing those songs as soon as you hear them. I'm going to go with Frozen for
that. Is a great pick. And I think it got wrongly, chastised or derided after it came out because it became such a
overexposure.
Almost like a pop culture punchline from overexposure with families. And let me tell you, again, as a dad of two young girls, we went through that in this house, even though they were born 5 years after it was released. That being said, I think this is one of those Disney movies 100 years from now, or is going to be in the canon of Little Mermaid and Snow White. Like, it's going to be top five 100 years from now. It is a stone cold classic. And there's a reason why Robert Lopez won an EGOT before he was 40. He is good at what he does. So that's a good pick. I didn't even have that on my list. I'm surprised I kind of missed that, actually.
Yeah, they wrote the Witch's Road song from Agatha All Along as well. And you can kind of tell when you listen to that song how good it is. They're really talented. We should also probably mention Pasek and Paul, since we've had a couple of movies that features their stuff on here as well, with La La Land and Greatest Showman. Just some really talented people writing some really cool stuff.
How does that make you feel, Andrew? Because I know you're my age, you're not 40 yet, that Robert Lopez got an EGOT, but at 39.
What are we doing with our lives, John?
I got a YouTube subscriber plaque for hitting 100,000. Is that on the same level as an Emmy, Tony, Oscar, Grammy?
I never got my 50K one.
Andrew, what is your final nomination?
Have we mentioned anything from Lin-Manuel yet? I don't believe we have.
Tick, Tick, we Boom.
Oh, Tick, Tick, Boom. That's right. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yep, that's right.
I'm going to go with In the Heights.
Yeah, that's a good that's a good choice.
I think that this movie, the music is great, but something that really stuck out to me and it reminded me a lot of Do the Right Thing, and what both of these movies do well is give you that sense of community in like a big city like New York or something like that.
A sense of place, really.
Exactly, yeah. I just found the diversity, not only in the cultures, but the scenery, beautiful. I found just the love. That's what this movie was all about to me, was just love. Like people, how they express love, show love to different people, what they would do. Like there's a song where what would they would do if they won the lottery or something like that. And it's like all the things they would do for other people. It's absolutely beautiful. And the music is just banger. So I love In the Heights.
There's
that's a great film. I want to go back and rewatch that one.
Yeah, there's so much great stuff in this. The Alabanza stuff always slays me. That pool number with the swimming pool is just insanely good.
I think that's the lottery. I think that's the if I won the lottery song was
that. Is it 96,000? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Good choice. Jonathan, what's your final nomination?
I was thinking of mentioning things like A Star Is Born or Mamma Mia, one depressing, one super fun. But I think my final
pick... Not only were you thinking of it, you actually did just mention them. So, you know.
I did mention it. I will instead select Les Miserables as my final pick. The 2012 update with Hugh Jackman, Anne Hathaway. She won an Oscar for that one. I really dig it. I think that was my first exposure to that story. And it's very moving. I recall crying during the I Dream a Dream scene. And Hugh Jackman, he's on my list twice for a reason. He is truly an expert showman. He is such an entertaining, affable, and enjoyable guy to watch. And he can sing like nobody's business. I actually think Russell Crowe's voice is pretty good in this. And a lot of people hate it. I kind of love it. And it's a great story. The French Revolution is an exciting backdrop. And it's a, you know, decades old classic for a reason. The music is really good.
John, I am a Russell Crowe apologist as well. So you're not alone.
Nice. It's like a really deep baritone and it kind of harmonizes well. It works.
It works for me.
I am not, but that's okay.
There's a good chance one of us wouldn't be. So that's why I brought it up.
Yeah.
Anne Hathaway's Dream a Dream scene is like if we were to do individual scenes, might be the one we chose. Like it's just insanely good. It'd probably be between her and Emma Stone and doing the song you already mentioned in La La
City of Stars and La La Land. City of Stars.
Okay, my final nominee. I've got several here to choose from. I think I'm going to pick the one that feels like it's different from almost anything else on this list and is the one I was talking about that it isn't really a musical. It's just a movie with a lot of great music in it, which I think is going to qualify it for me, which is Pitch Perfect. I'm going to put Pitch Perfect as my final nominee.
Totally counts. Yeah, I think great it pick.
It's just a great movie. And the reason I think the music works for me, in this context is because of the arrangements. The arrangements are so cool, so interesting. The acapella thing makes it unique, makes it great. And the story is really fun and lovable. And it's just a good movie from start to finish. And, there's a reason that there are three of these, because it really touched on something. I'm going to put Pitch Perfect as my final nominee.
And that is a great pick. And it's one of those low-key, kind of under-the-radar sports films because it follows all the beats of a great sports films, but it wraps it up with the musical kind of moments. And then, like you said, the arrangements make it so fun. And it's sort of a modern take on things. And how do you not love Anna Kendrick in that film? Just delightful.
I don't know how you would avoid loving her in that film.
Gosh, it's great. Good pick.
Let's talk about what didn't make the cut. You mentioned Star Is Born. Jonathan, I think that's one worth mentioning. Andrew, did you have any worth mentioning?
I was trying to look up animated, modern animated, but...
Well, I'll tell you the two that I had. Moana and...
I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Moana and Tangled. Tangled is real... Don't sleep on Tangled. Tangled is a great, great musical. That final song, When At Last I See the Light, it just like, just thinking about it, like I start getting emotional. So yeah, Tangled and Moana would be the two animated ones, that I think aren't on this list.
Yep.
Couple other honorable mentions, Chicago from 2002. I mean, that won Best Picture, right?
It's on my list. And
that's kind of why, I never mention it, because it already got like more accolades than it deserves. It's fine.
It's not my favorite. Not on my list, but that's one worth mentioning, maybe. And yeah. Into the Woods was kind of fun.
I loved Into the Woods. That was on my list of possibles, yeah.
And you mentioned the Aladdin remake. I think Rocket Man is also worthy consideration. I think, like you said, we kind of exclude it as it's a biopic or musical adjacent. But yeah, those would be my runners up.
Rocket Man. I never mind mentioning Rocket Man, because it should have had the success Bohemian Rhapsody had. Like, that is movie that should have won the awards that Bohemian Rhapsody won.
It's very frustrating that it went the other way, because Taron Egerton was robbed, quite frankly.
Yeah. Yep.
He was so good at it.
The only one that I haven't heard mentioned was the new Wonka. I think probably is worth putting in this conversation.
That was a lot of fun.
Because that is a ton of fun as well. All right. So here are the 12. Moulin Rouge, Greatest Showman, La La Land, Sing Street, West Side Story, Tick, Tick, Boom, Phantom of the Opera, Beauty and the Beast, the non-animated version, Frozen, In the Heights, Les Miserables, and Pitch Perfect. What are you guys thinking? What should we anoint here?
I think it's La La Land, right?
Probably. Well, if you're gonna you're gonna suggest La La Land, and Jonathan's gonna say probably, I'm not gonna stop us from making it La La Land, because that would definitely be
the Best Picture winner for exactly 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
Yeah, let's just call it La La Land. Is the best ever modern musical, according to SifPop. All right, let's finish off with one more review. Let's do the final artifact. Let's talk about We Live in Time.
There is something that your daddy and I...
There's something that mummy and me want to...
We want to talk to you about. It's a bit serious, though. Yeah.
What's happened to my underwear?
Oh, I literally have no idea.
So sorry, but do we know each other?
Yeah, no. I ran you over.
An up-and-coming chef and a recent divorcee find their lives forever changed when a chance encounter brings them together in a decade-spanning, deeply moving romance. I'll tell you if it's deeply moving. Movie synopsis. I get to make those decisions.
I hate when they tell you about the emotions you're intended to. Like, no, that's not how... You don't get to make that call.
It's up to me.
IMDb description.
This totally awesome, an epic movie.
You're gonna love... We Live in Time, Andrew Garfield and Florence Pugh, sign me up immediately. What did you guys think of We Live in Time? Did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay? Jonathan, why don't you start us off this time?
I liked it. Maybe even really liked it.
Jonathan, maybe even really liked it. Andrew, what about you?
I loved it.
Andrew loved it, as did I. Boy, did I love this movie.
I'll let you go first.
Okay, I'll go first then.
Because you really loved it.
As I mentioned, just sign me up for, like, you know how you have like season passes for some people? You're just like, whatever Andrew Garfield's doing, I want to see it. Like, he blows me, you know, we mentioned Tick, Tick, Boom already in this podcast. You know, whatever he is doing is usually going to impress me. I also have season tickets for Florence Pugh. Like, just... you know, shot onto the scene with an incredible 3-movie year a couple years ago and just can do no wrong. She's incredible. And to see them both in this movie, not just that they're in this movie, but they're both doing some of their best work in this movie. Some of the scenes that they're doing, their acting is just absolutely incredible. It was already starting from a place where I was going to at least like it. Like there was no chance I wasn't going to at least like this movie. You add to that, that it's about the beauty of how love can impact our decisions and who we are and what commitment looks like, what sacrifice looks like, what compromise looks like, what life looks like, what trauma looks like. This movie is really playing in some deep waters, and it does it really, really well. And it does it without making you feel morose the entire time. Like, somehow,
I appreciated that.
I loved that. Somehow this movie, and I don't get me wrong, I don't mind a movie that needs to live in the darkness a little bit, live in the muck a little bit for us to feel something. That's okay. Like, empathy can come in the darkness. But what's so beautiful about this movie is that it shows these human beings finding joy and finding moments of life and love amidst some trauma that's happening in their life. And I just found that really, really wonderful. The amount of smiles that I had, the amount of laughs I had. This movie's kind of funny. Like, there's some really funny moments in this movie. You know, and then that's before we even get to the nonlinear timeline that it's playing with in a very purposeful way, which I will save that conversation for here in a little bit, or let one of you guys start that conversation off. But yeah, just overall, I was just in it from the beginning and focused, and my heart was full, and I loved this movie. Really, really loved it. So, what about you, Andrew? What are some of your general thoughts?
Way to take all my notes, Aaron. I appreciate that.
Sorry. No, you'll just have to harmonize.
I really do appreciate the themes and the messaging of time in this movie. It's in the title, obviously, but how precious time is and what we do with the time we have, because for everybody, time is finite. And what you leave this in this world, you know, what you put out into the world is what you leave behind. So the more positivity you put out, the more positive you leave behind. And the more effort you put out, the more you're rewarded, or things that can be rewarding later on. Performances. Florence Pugh is one of my favorites. I can't think of a single project she was in that either I didn't love the project as a whole, or just walked away from her going, you know, wow, you were really good in that. What was the movie? I think it was Don't Worry, Darling. Is that the one that was Olivia Wilde?
Yeah, right.
The movie was okay, but Florence was great in it, you know? So there's just a lot of stuff out there that really has me excited for the future of her. And Andrew Garfield is just the best. I love him. I could definitely see myself watching this movie again. It made me cry. Made me laugh. It made me feel. And I think it did everything right that a movie's supposed to do.
Jonathan, some thoughts?
I wish I could say I loved it as much as you guys did. I feel like I went into this not in the best headspace, watching it immediately after the election results came in. I was not in a great place emotionally or mentally, but I went into it and I definitely really appreciated the performances. Echo everything you guys have said. I think Florence is probably the most talented actress working today. Andrew continues to show an incredible range from Spider-Man to this. And the one thing I'll say, that individual moments, and I loved all the different threads, and I loved their relationship developing in that sort of unique way that it does. The nonlinear thing for me felt, I was never confused by it because I knew where we were in the story at every moment. But I also, maybe you can help me understand the reasons or the improvements that format provided, because halfway into the movie, I'm still going like, why couldn't they just have done this linearly or with maybe a few flashbacks? But to have every scene in three different timelines, I think there was three, right? Three different timelines. That for me was like, all right, I feel like you're deliberately constantly trying to keep me off balance, because we know where it ends. So I get that there's a point to that end, right? You want us to know that they do have an ending with a child, but you also want us to know that these other things happened before and after that. So it was frustrating for me because I just wanted to experience their love story chronologically. So maybe you can help me understand why the movie was strengthened by just shooting all of it out of sequence, or showing it out of sequence.
Sure. I mean, I can tell you why it worked for me.
That's, I mean, as much as anybody can do, really.
For me, I think the themes of the movie are strengthened by the nonlinear storytelling, and I think my experience was strengthened with them, because there's an interesting thing that conversation you can have with spoilers, right? And I've had this conversation before, but there have been studies done on people who watch the movie after knowing the end versus people who watch something without knowing. And there is a real argument to be made that you are in a more susceptible and clearer headspace if you already know the ending. Like that you are able to relax into the story in a more interesting way. This is why when I talk about like not watching trailers and those kind of things, I really emphasize that it's actually not about spoiling the story for me. It's really mostly about spoiling the visual experience for me. The idea that scenes that aren't in the movie are sometimes in trailers and my brain is constantly looking for them, or I'm trying to put the context to something I saw in a trailer that in the trailer is a different context than it's going to be in the movie, so that that line or that moment has already been messed up for me or pre-contextualized in the incorrect way, like that kind of thing. So the story is kind of secondary to that. Do I like story surprises? Yes, I do. But there's also something beautiful about knowing some of the, I'm not going to say ending points, but near ending points in this relationship or things that happen later on, and then seeing some of the conversations that are had that kind of contradict with those things later on. And you're going, oh, that's interesting. How are we going to get from that point to there? So there's this almost this story math that
dramatic irony.
Yes, that my brain does through the movie, where it allows me to first think about what progression must happen, wonder how it's going to happen, and then watch it unfold and go, oh yeah. Like I don't know. For me, that's a little bit additive. Not just because it's good emotional storytelling, but because it's unique, it's different. If you put this story in a linear fashion, right? What my brain would be doing would be predicting. Okay, here's what's going to happen here. Here's what's going to happen here. This person is going to do this. Oh, I know a third act conflict cliche is coming up at some point. So I wonder if it's over this thing. And I'm predicting these things. And then I'm playing a game of where was I right? Where was I wrong? What did the movie do? This movie steals that distracting focus because it gives you pieces from near the end. And so there is a little bit of relaxing and going, I'm not playing any kind of predicting game. I'm just watching a story, and I'm finding out how we get from point A to point B, not what will point B be. What will to point B or not point B? That is the question.
First of all, thank you for crystallizing and articulating something I was unable to do, because that was my experience. And I think it frustrated me because I didn't quite understand what was happening in the moment. But you're absolutely right. When you take away the expectation or the worry of, it's like, well, this is kind of a maudlin story. I know it's probably not going to have a happy ending. I'm going to be on pins and needles the whole time waiting. What's going to happen? When is it going to happen? Who's it going to happen to? But instead, right away, we kind of know, oh, that's where the story is going to end up. And all these other moments and happy endings or happy middles are going to occur first. And we know they're going to occur first. So then later when we're seeing earlier, I think you're absolutely right. And I think you articulated it in a really helpful way, for me at least, to understand things, that it allows you that added focus, the dramatic irony of, we know what the characters don't. So I can relax on that aspect and focus mm-hmm. on the moment and the emotions in the moment. And individually, like every individual scene, they get into a fight early about their future. And I was like, whoa, this is kind of heavy stuff. Like they handled it really well. And there's a scene in a gas station rest mm-hmm. stop bathroom that was just like, oh my gosh, this is powerful. This is really intense.
I wept through the last probably 2 minutes, just crying through the last 2 minutes of that scene because of how beautiful it is. I'm getting choked up thinking about that gas station bathroom scene again. It was that meaningful to me. Sorry, I had to mention that when you brought it up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I The more I talk, that was funny. The more I talked about Joker, the more I realized that kind of sucked. The more we're talking about this one, the more I'm realizing, like, actually, no, it was deeper and more meaningful than maybe I was allowing myself to experience at the time, because I was just so, and I still am a bit, so like emotionally jaded and hardened this week. So I wanted to like just let myself weep and open up and experience, but I was like, oh, okay, whatever. Fine. That was kind of me watching it.
There's no love in the world.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd go that far, but it felt like it.
Yeah. Andrew, do you have other thoughts you want to talk about?
If this is too spoilerish, then Phil, cut it out. But for what the non-linear, what that worked for me is because we're given a bit of information at the beginning of the movie about the Florence Pugh character. And what that does, since it's non-linear, it makes every single moment afterwards feel more vital or more precious or more, what would you say? Anyway, if they'd done it linearly, that moment would have happened, I'd say, at the halfway mark of the movie, I'd imagine.
Probably at the end of the second act, end of the third act. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that would mean that there's a good 45, 50 minutes of this movie where I'm not understanding the point of the movie. I'm just following two people. And it's not until that 45 or 50 minute mark, if this is told linearly, that I go, oh, so that's what the movie's about. Since it's told way from the get-go, I get to see, now I understand what the movie's about. Now I can focus on the character portions of this and appreciate what the writer is trying to tell me.
No, that's absolutely right. I think if you approach it chronologically, it's a romance story that becomes a sort of drama and a tragedy. But with the way it's told non-linearly, you realize immediately, oh, this is a story about life and sort of purpose and ambition and figuring out what you want to do with your time and with your people. So that's a great point. And you guys have both kind of solidified for me what I was kind of failing to connect dots on. So thank you.
This will be my kind of one last thing as we look to kind of finish up our thoughts on this. I really appreciated the other part of this that really, really moved me. And again, I mentioned I was weeping during that scene and I cried at a couple other points as well.
Oh, yeah.
It's just how authentically human this movie is and how authentically human it lets its characters be. There are two examples of this that are two different areas that I think emphasize this for me. One is the nudity in this movie. I know it's weird sometimes to bring this up. I think the nudity in this movie is so human, so real. It's not only important in the sensuality of their relationship, it's important in the way her body is changing in the pregnancy. It's important in the way that they're connecting to each other. And there's a freedom to Florence Pugh's performance here and it's funny because so many people I'm close with would completely disagree with it at this point, but I think is elevated by her willingness just to be in her own skin. And I think that's really, really important to the movie. The other place is a very specific scene that I think emphasizes what I'm talking about. And I'll talk around it so I don't spoil it too much. But there's a scene where Andrew Garfield's character is told a revelation, and his response to that revelation is so perfect. And then it ends with throwing something away. And I was so moved by the humanity of that moment, the reality of what it means to be in a committed relationship, to forgive, to love, to cherish, to compromise. Like, there was so much embraced there about what love really looks like that a lot of times movies don't find a chance to get at. A lot of times it's about the joy and the feelings and the laughs, which are in here as well. But the movie also has the there's actually laughs in this moment of compromise in sacrifice. Like, it's, I don't know. I just found the movie's understanding of relationships to be just genuinely authentic, and understanding of humans to be really authentic as well. So that would kind of be the only other thing I wanted to kind of mention there.
I'll leap off of that. And I think that this movie shows not only are these two people in young love, you know, because it's a fresh new relationship, but also we see a maturity within the two of them as well. Mm-hmm. An understanding of what you would expect, you know, somebody, a couple celebrating their 20th or 30th year together to understand.
Yeah, because they're both like in their 30s, right? In this movie, the idea is there's like a, you know, like a decade in their 30s, maybe early 40s kind of thing. Either of you have any final thoughts? Any one last thing?
No post-credit scene.
I was just gonna quickly say to your point, Aaron, the weird prudishness that certain people, and certainly younger generations than ours, have about nudity, it baffles me, and I don't understand why that we should be ashamed of it or we shouldn't enjoy it. And like even if it's just nudity for nudity's sake, if it's completely gratuitous, I'm like, yeah, fine, this is great, it's a movie. Like, we're supposed to entertain. If your movie doesn't have a lot of plot or good acting or effects, like, yeah, throw some boobs at me and I'll be entertained. But when it's also and that's fine.
Throw some boobs at me. Yes. No human attached to them at all. No human. Literally said the opposite, which is that because the boobs were attached to a human that they mattered.
Aaron, it's go ahead, John.
I was going to get back around to that, whether it's that or I feel the more useful and more meaningful when it is in service of a story and a character in a moment. Because like you said, a lot of the nudity here, none of it is gratuitous. And so much of it is actually very natural and real. And it has like a rawness to it. I'm like, yes, this is painful. Even it's the kind of thing that like elevates the moment and makes it feel authentic, because they're not trying to movie around it and like just shoot from the neck up. Like, well,
exactly.
It would feel and less voyeuristic. It would feel like, oh, we're watching a movie. We're not watching a human moment. And it would frame it in a way that felt, inauthentic.
Here's the way I've often said it is that, you know, you can, this goes for the prudishness you're talking about, both sides of this idea of modesty, whatever you want to talk about when it deals with the human body, those kind of things. When you shoot it with the male gaze and you focus on those things, and they do become, gratuitous or whatever, objectification, those kind of things, I think that's a problem. I think there's some unhealthy things that come from a culture that is focused on the body in that way. But the same can be said for the other side. When you shoot around it, you also send a message. You also send a message that the other side is right, that those things are only good for objectification. They're only good for seeing in this certain way. And naturalized understanding of the human body, I think, is so important, because the repression that comes from the other side is just as unhealthy as the constant objectification of the body as only a sexual object. Like, that both of those things, are a problem. So the more naturalistic nudity in movies, I'm great with. Or in our life, like, I'm not saying we should all walk around naked all the time. Like, there's a reason we wear clothing. I understand. But I'm also saying, if you go to a beach and somebody's naked on the beach, it shouldn't bother you. Like, it's, you know, it's just a human body. Like, there's, anyways, I've gotten way too much into my naturism.
I'll tell you this. Who I really wish could have heard this conversation is the guy who was in my theater for this movie. Every single time Florence Pugh was naked, he would go, ooh. It was a fully grown man, too. Not like an 18-year-old kid or anything.
But that comes from that idea, right? That idea that, you know, the only time we see these parts of the body is, you know, it has to be, you know, this titillating thing. And it's just a body, you know? Go work as a nurse for a while, as my wife would say. Like, the human body will just become the human body very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So, and I think we all could use a dose of that. So anyhow, I liked that in this movie. I thought it made for a movie that didn't feel distracted by trying to avoid those things. It felt more authentic because it was able just to shoot that naturally and not worry about that. So
As usual, you articulated my thoughts better than I could have, so thank you.
All right. That is, again, We Live in Time. Huge recommend from me. Going to be one of my favorites of the year. I think Andrew really loved it as well. And I think by the end of this, Jonathan liked it more than he thought he did, too. So
that's very true. It is.
Yep. So there you go. Well, that's going to do it, guys. We did a podcast. Congratulations.
I had two Florence Pugh movies in my top five movies of the year right now.
Ooh, nice. Whoa. Nice. I'm guessing Dune, maybe? Dune.
Yeah.
All right. Very nice.
Good job, Florence.
She is very quickly producing an incredible resume of films. Just excellent, excellent stuff.
Because she's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, Oppenheimer, she's in that for a bit. Midsommar and Little Women. And she's been doing some great stuff for really only like 4 or 5 years now. But
she seems to be a very aware and proactive human, too. And, I got a chance to, at the Critics' Choice Awards a couple years ago, be on the carpet interviewing celebrities as they came in the carpet or whatever. And of all the celebrities I talked to, she was the most actively engaged in our conversation. Like she was, you know, listening to the questions I was asking, answering them, you know, with heartfelt answers, and just seemed,
That's really great to hear.
Yeah. So I just think she's a really an aware and proactive person, which is kind of cool to see as well. Well, there you go. That's going to do it for Sif Pop today. Thank you to Jonathan and Andrew for hanging out today and doing some stuff. Jonathan, before we get into the other thank yous, where can people find you?
This time around, I'd like to send folks to my third YouTube channel, /movie night. I'm going to be doing a big breakdown on those 31 horror movies I watched in October. Check that out. Subscribe so you can check that video when I drop it. Probably by the time you've listened to this podcast, it'll probably be out.
Go to YouTube and search for Movie Night to check out Jonathan's reviews there. Thank you to producer Phil for producing the audio and video show.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you, Andrew, for being with us again this week.
Thank you, buddy.
Much love and gratitude to our Sif Pop members for giving monthly to make Sif Pop a real thing. Appreciate you, too. That's support starts at $3 a month. That's all at Patreon, patreon.com/SifPop. You can connect with us in lots of ways. You can leave a comment, a rating, or a review wherever you listen, whether that's Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also email us feedback@SifPop.com if you like to. And finally, if you're having a good time, your movie-loving friends will probably like the show, too. So make sure you let them know about it and that listening is easier than tweezing your garnish with 10 seconds left on the clock. We'll be back I think next week we'll be back talking more movies. I'm sure there'll be plenty to talk about. It is award season, so we'll see you then.
Bye.
Leave that in, Phil.
No.
Leave that last
one. You make the call, Phil. You're the editor. You make the call.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.